The headlines this hour. Crowds of mourners attend a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, who was assassinated on Sunday. The death toll from the collapse of a building in southern Iran rises to 11 as rescue workers race against time to pull possible survivors from the rubble. And political crisis deepening in Tunisia, the labor union prepares for a nationwide strike after rejecting a national dialogue proposed by the president. This is news. Thanks for joining us. We begin this hour in the Iranian capital, Tehran, where earlier today a funeral procession was held for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. Hundreds of mourners attended the event, many of them holding pictures of Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi and chanting slogans against the United States and Israel. Khodayi was assassinated in his car and just outside of his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot 5 times by 2 motorcyclists. The IRGC has called this killing an act of terrorism. The IRGC's top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has pledged to avenge Khodayi's assassination, saying that the response will be tough and will make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has returned home from his groundbreaking visit to Amman. Raisi says the visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations. Let's see what he had to say about his visit.
We don't have much economic relations, and over the past couple of months, our business relations has doubled and stands at over $1 billion. But we believe that there's a lot of potential in order to develop these relations further. And as far as business relations are concerned, both countries and high-ranking officials of the two countries have signed MOUs in order to develop business and economic relations. In short, 13 MOUs and agreements were signed by the high-ranking officials of Iran and Oman. And this is considered a new page and a new chapter in our relations. Of course, we did have agreements that were signed before, but what really matters is for these agreements to be implemented. And, of course, one issue that was brought up is that these MOUs are not implemented. So this trip is considered a beginning of a new era in order to start implementing these MOUs. The basic pillar of these agreements are mostly regarding fiscal cooperation and also health tourism. Another issue that is important is that the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman can help strong regional relations, and good relations between the two countries can increase cooperation in the region, which was discussed in this meeting and all of the meetings that we had with high-ranking Omani officials. And we are pursuing stronger relations both with Oman and in the region.
Earlier, we were joined by the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajara. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf region.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Turning now to Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, where rescuers are combing through the rubble of a collapsed building for survivors. So far, at least 11 people are confirmed dead, and there are fears that the number of casualties could rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. Some 33 people have already been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road. The surrounding buildings have all been evacuated. The provincial governor says, based on initial technical assessments, questionable construction practices are the leading cause of the tragedy. 10 people, including the city's mayor and several people involved in the construction of the major trade center, are in detention. The owner is said to have lost his life in the incident. Let's now listen to comments by the president of the Iran Red Crescent Society, Pir Hossein Kolivand, about the ongoing rescue operations at the site.
Rescue teams are working to their fullest potential. Operations are in progress at a higher speed thanks to the deployment of more and better equipment to the area. We are trying to access the underground level to save those trapped there. All buildings in the vicinity of the collapsed structure have been evacuated to protect residents from potential risks.
Iran's foreign ministry says the United States' open support for Israel has further emboldened the occupying regime. The ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that this has been worsened by international indifference to the regime's repeated acts of aggression against Syria. Khatibzadeh condemned Israel's recent missile strikes in Damascus, saying the regime's military is serving the air force of terrorist groups operating in Syria. He said that Israel launches attacks whenever the Syrian army scores a victory against terror outfits. The spokesman also underlined the need for a strong response to Israeli acts of aggression, both on the battlefield and at the international level. On Friday, Israel launched a large-scale missile attack in Damascus, killing 3 people and razing buildings near a key mosque in the city. Tunisia's political crisis deepening, the country's labor union rejects the president's proposed national dialogue and says that it will hold a nationwide strike over economic woes. The UGTT says that it will not take part in an advisory committee set up by President Kais Saied to discuss political and economic reforms. The union says that it rejects any dialogue where roles are unilaterally determined. Last week, Saeed designated a law professor to head the committee of legal and political science experts to draft a new constitution. However, he barred political parties from any role in the process. The main opposition party, Ennahda, has also rejected Saeed's move, saying that it lacks constitutional legitimacy. Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis since June 2021, when Saeed dismissed the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. The president's opponents accuse him of a coup. A correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Johnny Miller, reports from the Donbas region to find people who no longer wish to be part of Ukraine.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbas People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartments 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theater. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, statues like this that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Jenny Miller, Donetsk.
Despite EU efforts to boycott Russian energy, Italy has increased its imports of crude oil from Moscow to feed its refineries. As a result, Rome is set to become the EU's largest importer of Russian crude.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. This would result in the loss of thousands of jobs and an enormous damage to the national and local economy.
This definitely risks aggravating the employment situation in Italy's already depressed south. It's paradoxical. Brussels wanted to penalize Russian energy imports, but in Italy it's actually been incentivized by the sanctions. And there is also the Russian gas issue. It's going to take at least 2-3 years before Italy manages to cut its dependency on Moscow.
Members of the bloc have yet to reach an agreement on an embargo on Russian oil. This way, the Russian energy industry has largely avoided direct bans.
Two solutions have been suggested to the problem. Either Italy continues this way until a full embargo on the Russian crude is imposed, or the Russian company gets nationalized with its assets being put under special administration by Italy's government.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany, Max Civili, Rome.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. I thank you very much, honorable gentlemen, for thinking of this endeavor and taking this great step. Of course, this is just a preliminary step. This means that your action and this commemoration of Hamza, greetings be upon him, is groundwork for future endeavors. The main work must be done by art, and the performing arts, linguistic and visual arts must be used in order to achieve the purpose of honoring and commemorating a personality like Hamza. Otherwise, the mere act of organizing commemoration ceremonies will not serve the purpose just because it will be broadcast in the media and just because the name of that personality will be mentioned there for a certain period of time. The task that you want to carry out, creating a culture and presenting role models, cannot be done except with artistic work, and it will remain incomplete if artistic methods are not used. Therefore, what you are doing is very good.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As you pointed out, you must rely on precision and improve quality as much as you can. This will help those who are doing artistic work to have the necessary resources and documentations at their disposal. Now I wish to raise a few points about Hazrat Hamza. He is really one of the lesser known companions of the Messenger of God. Greetings be upon him and his household. Despite the role that he played when he announced his faith, The way that he announced his faith was really astonishing as well. He publicly shouted that he had become a Muslim after having heavily beaten Abu Jahl, cited by Ibn Athir. Ibn Athir says this in Usdul Ghaba, the Lions of the Forest. This was his manner of faith, and as for emigration to Medina, in that glorious Islamic fortress that the Holy Prophet wanted to build in that small environment, his presence was very effective. According to one narration too, the first Sariya, that is the small army that the Holy Prophet dispatched without his own presence, that the Holy Prophet dispatched was led by Hazrat Hamza. He gave him a banner and sent him to battle. His role was also outstanding in the Battle of Badr.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Elena Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000, and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Duhan said, the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with US sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following, that some medicine are produced domestically. At the same time, the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession, for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles.
The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is set to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long, unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideens, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cults. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in the hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the U.S. government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the U.S. support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the U.S. and Europe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: كل وعاء يضيق بما جعل فيه إلا وعاء العلم فإنه يتسع به.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Every container gets narrower according to what is placed in it, except knowledge, which expands instead."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, the heart is one of the most astounding parts of the human body. Now, when we find in the traditions and we find in the Holy Quran or when we find in the traditions or in the teachings of spiritual masters, of course, spiritual masters who predominantly all of them trace their teachings back to Imam Ali alayhi salam, these universal masters, the divinely appointed Imams, the Holy Prophet, the messengers of Allah in general, and the Holy Quran, they all talk about this heart, whether in its physical sense or in its metaphorical sense. This heart is truly where Allah resides. Now, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about this organ of the human heart. And he says that the most wonderful organ of the human body is their heart. It is in this organ that the phenomena of wisdom and likewise its opposite are manifested. If the heart is hopeful of anything, then the hardship, the calamity of greed overtakes the heart. And if the heart is incited and inflamed by greed, it will be ruined. Of course, in many programs and many teachings, we find that the resting place and the abode and the home of Allah is in this heart, and so it is this heart which we must protect at all costs. In some places, the heart and the soul and the intellect are considered to be one thing. But here, when we're talking about the heart, we're talking about this emotional center. We are talking about this aspect or this part of the human existence and the human entity which has the love for Allah within it. Now, if we take these traditions into mind, that the heart is the place where Allah lives, and the heart is the place where the love for Allah exists, then at all costs we must protect this heart. And here Imam Ali alayhi salam says that if one's heart becomes hopeful for anything, it desires something, it looks towards something, it yearns for something, it desires something, then naturally greed becomes to overtake it. And this is especially important when it comes to materialistic things. And if this heart becomes greedy for something, then it will be fueled and inflamed and afire and incited by greed. And this, just like anything else which is put aflame, will become ruined. And so we must protect our heart from at least the materialistic love of this world, for it will lead to greed, and greed will lead to its ruin. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away, and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you.
تبكي عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته Do you want to be healthy and feel good? Perhaps you won't find anyone not sharing this goal. Whilst there's a plethora of advice online and by experts, we have wonderful recommendations in Islamic teachings, including the sayings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام. They all lived a healthy life and would love their followers to be healthy too.
For instance, I have personally found hundreds of narrations on healthy lifestyle from the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Here are tips in this regard. Number one, oral hygiene. In many riwayat traditions, Imam Ali alayhi salam encourages the usage of the miswak, which is a teeth cleaning twig, which has been used for over 7,000 years. Although it is still widely available and can indeed be used, the emphasis in these narrations can perhaps be extended to general oral hygiene, such as brushing the teeth, gargling, as well as flossing. Your mouth is where the Quran is being recited, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, so hence purify it. In another narration, he says that cleaning the teeth pleases Allah is the sunnah of the Holy Prophet and a cleanser for the mouth. Number two, washing the body with water. The commander of the faithful, peace and blessings be upon him, is reported to have said, use water to rid your bodies from unpleasant smells, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dislikes the unclean ones, especially those who smell and annoys anyone next to them. Indeed, the Holy Quran states that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves those who purify themselves. We have all heard how cleanliness is part of Iman according to Hadith. As Muslims, therefore, we must practice what our inspirational leaders have emphasized. Showers and baths, therefore, should be a very regular practice. Interestingly, in the book Makarimul Akhlaq, it is reported that Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends drinking 3 handfuls of hot water before having a shower or a bath to remove any pains in the body. Number three, washing hands before and after eating. Wash your hands before and after food, for this increases sustenance, rizq, as well as improves eyesight. This was a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. It points to the esoteric link behind some actions that we do to maintain personal hygiene. It will be both good for our bodies as well as result in favors of the Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala, such as more blessings from him.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The murder of Shireen Abu Akleh by an Israeli sniper has shocked the world. Her death and the horrifying attack on the mourners at her funeral have even been condemned by governments that staunchly support the temporary entity. Today, we'll look at Shireen's murder and how it's yet another example of the ongoing onslaught against journalists by the Zionist regime. Later in the show, we'll look at how Zionist propagandists work closely with pro-Israel journalists to distort how the world views Palestine. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to